Please join us in unison from the order of service as we light our chalice. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. Albert Schweitzer. Complex information creates failure. For example, you do not have 2.4 children. Not every single thing written in scriptures is literally true. Seemingly all computer programs contain bugs. DNA replication may cause mutation. Human beings often make mistakes, often. Clusters of galaxies accelerate apart from each other. Information can be packaged in various forms, but the complex nature of information is the same. Whether information is assembled in a scripture, a computer, a galactic cluster, or a human being, information complexity leads to the possibility of unexpected results and fallibility. That complexity, that fallibility is where we are. We are humans here on Earth. This fellowship does not worship human beings nor scripture. We do not worship candles nor galactic clusters. We do not accept anything complex as perfect. Here we search for truth and meaning in a complex sea of information. My name is Susan Thayer. The music today is performed by Sally Riggers, and today's speaker is Jonathan Prescott, who will be speaking about finding balance in the midst of loss. This is the first of a two-week series that will be followed next week by Jonathan's conclusion and workshop. It just occurred to me that I didn't actually light the chalice. Often. There. So Jonathan returns next week with a service which includes a workshop and this document. Both sessions are linked, so please stay for the second part next week, which he will also lead. Also next week, Sally will gather the children and take them to the CRE room so that we can be more focused on our workshop. Thank you for coming by here this morning and for participating to your level of satisfaction. A few minutes from now, we will literally sing Kumbaya. The phrase singing Kumbaya has become a pejorative used to disempower liberal groups. Political agitators have captured Kumbaya as a description of naive, feel-good actions with ineffective results. Words can change meaning over time. 100 years ago, the word gay was used as a slight to a group of people. Gay people recaptured that word as their own. African Americans are doing the same with the infamous N-word. The hatred that words can become charged with can also be diffused over time. We will work at recapturing singing Kumbaya by doing it with enthusiasm. Kumbaya is too good of a word to cede it to the haters. The song originated as a slave song, making a plea for God's presence. Kumbaya, come by here. Raise your hand if you don't like unexpected results to participate by raising your hand. Interesting. Before we sing, I'd like to warm up with a bit of participation. Raise this hand. Lower it. Did you notice that it did not matter which hand you raised? Some matched me like a mirror. Some raised the same anatomical hand. Both choices were correct, but only the choice that you made was correct for you. Raise the other hand and lower it. Do you notice it still didn't matter which hand you raised? You make good choices. Let's make another choice. Please stand either vertical or in the fourth dimension as we sing hymn 401, Kumbaya. We're going to sing all six verses.
Oh, am I doing this? Oh, okay. I'll do this.
Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya. Someone singing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone singing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone singing, Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya. Someone's laughing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's laughing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's laughing, Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya. Someone's weeping, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's weeping, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's weeping, Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Oh Lord, kumbaya.
Good job.
Thanks, Kathy. So I had Kathy up here to sing because today we're doing something a little different than we've done in the past. We're actually recording the service. So recording me singing Kumbaya or recording Kathy? Welcome to the Skagit Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Immediately following the service, please join us for refreshments and coffee. We will socialize for a while, and then two things will happen. Following the service this Sunday, Jim Hurd will substitute for Nancy Miller to lead an interactive class on the 7 UU principles. The class will take place right here in the sanctuary. Also following the service, children, parents, and friends of children will meet in the classroom for an educational activity. Every week,
So the Shermans are going to be leading the educational activity. We're going to start by watching the documentary Happy, which is about the science of happiness. So if you want to join us, we did the hand-raising thing, but if you're able to kind of give me a signal of how many people want to be there, I can make enough copies of the materials we have. The documentary isn't over an hour long, but we're just looking at the first 16 minutes of it today. So now. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, thank you.
See you later. We'll have some vegetarian food too.
Well, we had a little disagreement in my family over whether we're going. We're going, Alyssa. Every week in our church, we take up an offering. The offering is symbolic as well as practical. We know that it's through pledges that we build our budget and fund our yearly programs, pay our staff, and finance our building. We could easily submit these pledge checks to the church at any convenient time. But we pass the plate during our worship service to make a community expression, to visibly bring in the harvest at this most cherished hour of our week. Our offering says that the act of giving is an essential part to our spiritual well-being as anything else we do here on Sunday mornings. The offering will now be given and received in the spirit of grateful fellowship.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and soft summer nights. We'd hide from the lights on the village green. When I was 17, when I was 21, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stair with their perfumed hair that came undone when I was 21. When I was 35, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for blue-blooded girls of independent means. We'd ride in limousines. Their chauffeur would drive when I was 35. But now the days are short. I'm in the autumn of the year. And now I think of my life as vintage wine from fine old kegs. From the brim to the dregs, it poured sweet and clear. It was a very good year.
Yay. So I mentioned that we're recording this morning. This next little portion we're not recording, and that's going to be the modus operandi going forward, I understand. If you woke this morning with a... We'll now enjoy a solo performance by Kathleen on May the Life I've Lived Speak.
Good morning. On the top of the music, I'm just going to read the little intro here. The message of this memorial song is simple and honest. When my days are done, when I come to the end of my road, let my actions, my friendships, my struggles, and my caring speak for me. There's no need for embellishment or praise. The truth, a plain yet beautiful truth, will suffice. Let the life I've lived speak for me. Let the life I've lived speak for me. When I come to the end of my road and I lay down my head, let the life I've lived speak for me. Let the friends I've made speak for me. Let the friends I've made speak for me. When I come to the end of my road and I lay down the heavy load, let the friends I've made speak for me.
Jonathan Prescott is a long-time ordained student of Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. After serving as chaplain and cancer care navigator for Island Hospital and as spiritual counselor for Hospice of the Northwest, Jonathan founded Wise Caregiving, a nonprofit dedicated to helping people become more open-hearted, sustainable, and effective caregivers. He writes and speaks frequently about finding the happiness that is always nearby. Please welcome Jonathan now for Finding Balance in the Midst of Loss.
Thank you, Susan. Hi. I sat down in the front row, and there were a few people here, and I stood up and we sang Kumbaya, and the whole room was full. It was amazing. So I feel like sometimes I arrive here and I'm kind of the like the Grim Reaper. You know, I always talk about these difficult things. And I do that because my experience is that it opens a door for us that we don't otherwise open. If we can really face the difficult things that are going on. I got to have a real experience of that this week. I spent most of the week at Harborview, where my mother was having surgery. And I got to be present with suffering on a grand and vast scale. And it really reinforced for me why I do the work that I do, because it is a door that we can go through to happiness that we don't get unless we are brave enough to go through that door. So I want to start today by telling a story. And this is a story that is purportedly a true story, but who knows, things come down through time. There was a young woman, her name was Kisa Gotami. She lived during the time of the Buddha, about 2,500 years ago. And she had a very blessed life. She was wealthy. She had a young son, an infant son. Her husband was kind to her. She had a great relationship with her parents and with her in-laws. They all lived together. Things were going very well for Kisa. And one day, unexpectedly, this flood came. And they lived right by the river. Their house was by the river. And the flood came and swept away their house. It swept away her parents. It swept away her husband and his parents. And she had her son in her arms, and the water was rising and rising, and the flood swept away her son as well. And she was absolutely grief-stricken by this, devastated. She found the body of her son there on the riverbank, and she carried the body of her son around with her from house to house, wailing in grief, overcome. Finally, someone said, well, I've heard that the Buddha is nearby with the Sangha. Maybe you should go and talk to the Buddha. Maybe the Buddha can help. And so she did. She found her way with her lifeless son, just like the orca that carried her baby for so long. She carried this lifeless son to the Buddha. And she just fell apart in front of him and begged for his help. And he said, I think I can help you. All I need you to do is to go to the houses in the village and collect sesame seeds. Just go to each door and knock on the door and ask for a sesame seed. Oh, and one more thing. You can only get a sesame seed from a house that has not been touched by death. So she said, okay, great, I'll find those houses and I will bring back those sesame seeds and the Buddha will help me. And she went door to door and she asked, do you have a sesame seed? And they said, oh yeah, sure, we'd be happy to give you a sesame seed. Have you been touched by death? Oh yes, my mother died just last week. In another house, oh yes, my beloved daughter, she died. And she went house to house through the entire village and found that there was not a single house that had not been touched by death. So she went back to the Buddha and she said, I've brought no seeds, but now I understand. And together they were able to bury her son, and she was able to begin the process of grieving and letting go. And it turns out that Kisa became a nun with the Buddha. And she taught many, many people about how to cope with the losses that she had experienced. So this is a kind of a difficult story. And I thought about this story when I was at Harborview, because there's a kind of a way we talk about death in Buddhist practice. We use mythology. We use a kind of a talking about different hell realms. We talk about this one being a heavenly hell realm. Kisa was in the heavenly hell realm. We think, what is this? Heavenly hell? What is that? That's not what we're socialized to understand. But there is a way of thinking about the way that we live. You know, really, many of us have a kind of life that is like Kisa's life. It is so blessed with abundance. We have what we need. We go through our life thinking that not only is all this stuff my birthright, but that it'll never be taken away from me. So when I was at Harborview, I happened to be in the room with my mother, and her roommate had been in a terrible car accident, broken both her legs, and been exactly this situation. So I started thinking about Kisa. I thought, maybe we should talk about Kisa today, because all of us are in this place too. So the reason this is important for us to talk about is that we can go through our lives believing that we have what we need to be happy, and we will retain what we have to be happy, and that things will never change. But experience will tell us, if we really look closely, that all the time we are gaining and losing, gaining and losing. And if we are like Kisa, or like this person that I met at Harborview, if we don't pay attention to the loss and gain that's happening in every moment of our life, we will be so shocked by the drama of the big losses that we won't be able to cope with them. And so I'm hoping that we can work together and begin to look at those losses and gains that are part of our life, so that when the big things happen, we can say, oh, I'm expecting you. I knew that you were here. I knew you were coming. So let's talk a little bit about grief. Grief is really about hoping for a different past. Something has happened, something that we did not want to have happen. We've lost something. And in this moment, that loss has already occurred. But our grieving is wishing that we had a different past, that had not occurred. And so we spend a lot of our effort trying to revise history. Well, how's that going to go for us, right? It's not really ever going to help. We're not going to get there. So I want to talk about grief in sort of two modes here. One is the bodily experience of loss. And the other is the mind and heart's experience of loss. And when I talk about grief and I talk about the possibility of changing our relationship to it, I just want to say that I don't ever want you to carry a message from me that says you shouldn't experience this. You shouldn't experience grief. You shouldn't feel the full pain of it, that somehow you're not doing it right. I do not want you to have that message. Not at all. But what I do hope is that by talking about this and looking deeply into this, we might be able to find ways that we can cope with our grief differently so that it doesn't tear us apart in the future. So grief of the body, I mean, this is a real thing. I don't need to tell anybody here. I mean, you've all experienced these kinds of losses, and it can just hit you like a sledgehammer physically there. You know, when I was with my grandmother and she was dying, I was so grief-stricken, I could not speak. This took over my body. So in this kind of grieving that we experience, the best thing we can do is to completely allow it to be just as it is, without manipulating it or changing it, guiding it, wishing it away, judging it. No, just let it be there. It's hard. But what choice do we really have? You know, people say, oh, you know, things will be better for you in the future, or, you know, you could have another child, or these kind of things that really don't do us much good. We have to be available for our grief just as it is. It's a bodily thing. And our body does what our body does. But there is another aspect of our grief that we have a little bit of influence over, and that's our thinking about what's going on. So that's what I want to spend most of my time talking about. But again, I don't want to give you the message that if you're feeling that sledgehammer of grief, that there's something wrong with you, that you're not doing it right. That's not true. That's not true. You are doing it right. You're a human being. And this is what happens to human beings. So one of the tools we can use when we're grieving to help with our mind and our heart is to develop the quality of equanimity. It's this kind of balance that we can have in our life so that whatever comes our way, we can flow with it without being tipped over. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it is possible for us to have this kind of sense of equanimity. So equanimity is the quality of moving through the world without losing our balance. What would that be like? What would that be like? There's a sutra in Buddhism that says, to live in the world with your heart undisturbed by the world, this is the greatest happiness. And that's kind of this kind of sense of equanimity, of moving through the world with an open heart. But that's not about detachment or failing to care. It's actually the opposite of detachment and failing to care. True equanimity opens our hearts so broadly that everything comes in and we don't leave anything out. That's very different from the kind of false equanimity that says, oh, I don't care. Whatever happens is fine. Yeah. So I'll talk about equanimity first as a mature observation. So in Kisa's case, when she saw that she was not the only person to suffer, that the entire village had had losses like she had had. They weren't her particular losses, but they all knew that pain. That gave her a kind of mature observation of the world. Before, she had a little more of an immature observation of the world that said, I have everything I need, and if I'm deprived of them, there's something wrong with things. That's an idea that we carry a lot, but it's a sort of an immature idea. But I think she was able to mature in this process and see more broadly, this loss of mine is horrible, and it's devastating to me. And I know that this is what it means to be a human being, because I've gone and I've checked and I've seen for myself that this is the case all through the village. So I wonder if we might be able to gain that kind of a mature observation for ourselves by practicing as we go along, seeing loss and gain in every moment of our lives. And what would it be like if we actually made a practice of seeing our body as a constant process of loss and gain? You know, physically, our cells are completely changed in our bodies every 7 years. We're not the same physical being we were months ago, minutes ago, years ago. It's really happening, this loss and gain. It's really happening right here in our body, right now. It's happening as you age and you realize that, I can no longer lift that heavy grocery out of the car and I need some help. There's loss. It's a little loss, and you may need to grieve that. But living in this way, we can prepare ourselves for the great dramatic losses that are certainly coming our way, because we see that they are just life. They are just life. So that's one way to do that, to have that kind of mature observation. There's another way we can foster equanimity, and that's by developing our kind of open-heartedness. So what I mean by that is, I don't know if you're like me, but one of the things that I really struggle with is judgment. You know, I can be quite judgmental of whether this is the right thing or not for me. For instance, I was flying recently, and I was sitting in my already really small seat by my judgment, And I'm a small guy, right? So I would hate to be a great big person and have that same seat. But here I am sitting in this seat, and the person next to me is quite large and is sort of spilling into my seat. So this is a long flight all the way from France, right? And then the person comes and sits in front of me, and also a very large person, and is so large that it pushes the seat sort of back, you know, just his weight, just kind of push the seat back. And so I'm thinking, okay, I've got 13 hours here in this sort of like this. And I started to get judgmental about that, right? That I'm not going to be happy all this way. And I thought, oh, okay, right. Mm-hmm. I see where I'm going. So I practiced that equanimity of having an open heart, of seeing, here I am on this airplane, flying through the air in comfort and safety, on a trip that would have taken our ancestors months to make in a little wooden boat on the sea that goes like this, you know? And I'm just sitting here on this plane being taken care of and fed, and I can get up and go to the bathroom when I want to. What do I have to complain about? But my judging mind, of course, was saying, well, it's not perfect. It's not exactly what I wanted. But I found that when I don't judge the way things are, joy is actually possible in practically every situation that I find myself in. I'm not advocating that we need to be exposing ourselves to great suffering and poverty and things that physical deprivation or lack of safety. I'm not trying to make those seem like they're great things. No, not at all. But in the lives we lead, we're largely free of those things. And even if the life we lead doesn't meet our preferences, we can still find a great deal of joy in our life as we go. There was a 9th century Chinese Zen master that said, the path is not difficult, it just precludes picking and choosing. You know, what would it be like if we could walk through our day and say, this is what it is, instead of, ooh, I want that, instead of that. And you see right in front of you, this is what it is. Here it is. In our monastery in Escondido, California, there's a big calligraphy that made by Thich Nhat Hanh that's right up behind and just in that spot and says, this is it. Whatever this is it. And because it's this, it's not that. And if I'm pining for that, I'm missing this. And there's great joy in being available for this, because this is what life is right now. We are it. We are together. We are it. There's great joy in this. As I listen to the service and sing the hymns with you all, I'm finding tremendous joy in being here with you. This is it. How lovely that is. So this equanimity that can help us with grief is not something that we can force on ourselves. It's something that sneaks up on us as we practice. So my hope is that you can turn yourself towards what is and open your heart and have that mature observation of what is. And in doing that, in every little aspect of your life, equanimity will find you. So for instance, when at the end of the service, if there are snacks available, maybe saying, this is it. This one right in front of me. Not, that one or that one or that one, but this one. And how sweet that tastes. How sweet that is. So if I'm going to give any sort of advice about how we might go forward in this, I would say this. So that if we want to have this equanimity that makes it easier for us to face life and grief and loss, let's start with allowing. Let's start with allowing things to be as they are. So this was a great example, thank you so much, about, you know, here we had the need for water. And when Susan just allowed that to be, look what happened. You know, the congregation took care of it. It was beautiful. It was part of the service. And how different that is from what could be of judgment of each other. Oh, I didn't do this right, or that didn't, you know. It was beautiful. It was just what we needed. Allow, right? Allow. Similarly, we can choose to turn towards what is difficult instead of away from what is difficult. So what would it be like if you felt sadness or anger or, again, judgment, and rather than turning away from it saying, no, I shouldn't do that, I shouldn't feel that way, I'm a good person, you could actually turn toward it and say, what is this? What does this feel like? Ooh, what is this experience? When I was driving up from Harborview back up home on Guemes Island, I was really pretty exhausted by the experience there. And I just didn't have any patience at all. And I watched myself judging driver after driver after driver. There was nothing anybody could do that was right, right? So I consciously made a decision that I was not going to judge this experience. I was simply going to notice it. And so I'd see, oh, there's a big truck in the left lane. They shouldn't be in the left lane. I say, okay, that's judging. What does it feel like? Ooh, it feels like a twisting in my stomach. I can feel that I'm very unhappy when I'm doing this. I just watched that. And I watched how I would have one moment of judging, a little bit of a break, and then another one, and a little bit of a break, and another one. It was very instructive for me to just watch it. I turned toward it, and I learned something about it. I learned it was just a habit of mind. It wasn't truth. It wasn't truth about what was going on. It was just a habit of mind. It was my exhaustion. Another thing we can do to help foster this kind of equanimity is have some kindness. You know, when things don't go the right way, we can be kind to ourselves that we're experiencing this difficulty. This is hard. You know, my judgment as I was driving, that hurt. It hurt physically in my body. It was hard on me. And yet, there it was. There it was. So I could have some kindness to myself. And once I had enough kindness in myself, I could start to lay the judgment down and be kind to the people on the road that I was judging. You know, they're doing the best they can. They're doing the best they can, just like me. I'm not a perfect driver. I make lots of mistakes. I cut people off, you know. Geez. Kindness. And finally, as my mother's always said to me since I was a little one, this too shall pass. When we're in a situation that's really hard, this too shall pass. I got home. I stopped judging the drivers. This would pass. I took a nap. I felt better. Whatever difficulty we're in, we will look back on with different eyes than we have right now in the middle of it. And I felt overwhelmed by a lot of the suffering that I was participating in and witnessing at that big trauma center in Seattle. I really felt overwhelmed by that. But I'm not there now. That passed. That passed. And I can take that knowledge with me back there, and next time I go back, I can say, okay, I can be with this because I know it will pass. So these are some things that we can do in our daily lives to foster this equanimity, this allowing, turning towards, kindness, knowing it will pass. And then next week, we'll pick up something very practical that we'll do together. So one of the manifestations I've noticed in the work that I've done in hospice and in the hospital and the cancer center is that we all want to believe that our life will never end. And we know intellectually that people die, but me, not so much, not so much. So we put off actually making plans for that. And one of the things that we're going to do together in the second hour next week is we're going to actually take out the paperwork and make some plans, write some things down, fill out some forms, do these concrete things that are putting this kind of opening of our hearts to the way things are on paper so that we can help each other, help our loved ones, and make their suffering less. So that's what we'll do. I'll talk about those kind of decisions next week, and then we'll do it together. So let's end with a little bit of a meditation. I've kind of given a lot to you guys. Let's let it settle out into our bodies. So I invite you to find a comfortable position that represents your human dignity, upright, solid, with your feet touching the floor, your bottom and your legs and your back touching the chair, feeling that solidity. Feeling your connection to the earth. And as you breathe in and out, notice that this is it. This is your life right now. There are things that are beautiful and wonderful in your life right now. And there may be things that you don't like. Pains, sorrows, fears, they're here too. This is it. And as we breathe in and out, feel the presence of the people around you. You are not alone. You do not need to do this by yourself. The feeling of the earth coming up through your feet and through your body lets you know that you are connected to this earth, this broad, vast, supportive, forgiving earth. Just as you are now, you are enough. You are enough. So I invite you to bring your awareness back to this amazing congregation in this beautiful facility, and how lucky we are to all be here together so that we can walk down this path of gain and loss together, supporting each other, making this being human an amazing, amazing thing. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan. Without judgment, I can say that that was not perfect. And we all appreciate it. Join me now by rising vertically or in the direction of your choice and sing hymn number 350, The Ceaseless Flow of Endless Time. Thank you. We have shared our joys and concerns. We've heard words of inspiration and hope. We've sung songs of reflection. We've considered easing the burdens of those who suffer to stand for decency and compassion. But these are just words. The hymns we sing are just songs. All our reflections are just idle thoughts. When we convert them into a loving and responsible action throughout the week, then and only then will this morning be what we want it to be, a time of worship. Please join in unison as we extinguish the chalice. The care and respect that we wish for ourselves is also what we wish for all people. We reciprocally spark new light in each other while maintaining respect for extinguished flames. And I remembered to blow it out. So gather now around the edge of the sanctuary, join hands or touch elbows, and sing the closing words written on the wall.